Today, I'd like to invite you to examine some assumptions with me. Let's examine the assumptions that we make about ourselves and others, and especially the assumptions that we make about God. Because I believe that Jesus' life was about liberation. And one of the ways that he went about this work was by dismantling judgmental assumptions that trapped people in a small-minded way of practicing religion. Studies show that within seconds of meeting someone, we've already decided how trustworthy they are, how good a leader they are, whether we like them or not, and about how much money they make. Most of the time, the snap judgments that we make can determine whether it's safe to trust someone. They can help us. But our assumed biases also have a cost. They limit how we listen to each other, how we include others in the stories that we tell about ourselves, and even what images come to mind when we think about God. This is how good Christian people accidentally imagine God to be an old judgmental white man in the sky, demanding good deeds in exchange for blessing. It's also how we can participate in social assumptions like white supremacy, or classism, or ableism, without even realizing it. Over time, unexamined social assumptions become sources of isolation and shame that bind us in profound ways and plug our ears from hearing anything new. Jesus knew that, and he sought to liberate us by upending our assumptions and waking us up to the subconscious stories that we tell about ourselves. The parable we hear from Luke today is like an intervention, a tool for divine liberation. We hear from Luke that Jesus addressed some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. But I think it's also important to note the context that isn't written in. Jesus' audience was likely a community of followers eager to be taught and challenged. Furthermore, this was a group of oppressed Jewish people seeking to live as God intended in the power-hungry Roman Empire. Both of the men that Jesus describes in this parable are members of this faithful community, anchored in a shared history of struggling with God in prayerful relationship. They are different, but they're not enemies. The Pharisee is a good, upstanding man, dedicating his life to justice and communal leadership. He prays by reciting his spiritual practice resume to God, or maybe just to himself. But either way, he is successful, according to every definition in the Torah, and that's how he knows that he's better. We wince at his comparison. But we've all done it. Thank God that I'm not like that. Or as we say in the South, bless his heart. Tax collecting was a contemptible occupation in the Jewish community at the time. The tax collector's work required him to solicit Roman taxes from his Hebrew neighbors. And it wasn't uncommon for people in his position to take a little off the top for their own personal gain. But even if this particular tax collector didn't personally swindle his neighbors, even if he felt forced by the circumstances of his life to make a living in an unseemly way, it's unlikely that anyone would have assumed his goodness. But he too goes to the temple and prays beside the Pharisee in the tradition of the Psalms and the Lamentations of Jeremiah. God, be merciful to me. Then Jesus' story upends, as all good parables do, and we're left with a collaborator to the empire, justified by God, a good man justifying himself, and an admonition about being humble. It would have been a startling end for Jesus' original audience, and with good reason. I have to confess, though, that Jesus' story doesn't startle me anymore. I've heard it so many times. I just assume that pious Pharisees are always the bad guy in the Bible. Many a commentary extols God's relentless grace and mercy to the undeserving tax collector, and that's good. But they ridicule the self-righteousness of religious leaders, and rarely have those interpretations produced more mercy in my life. Some have even been outright anti-Semitic. Surely that's not what God intended. Besides, in today's world, aren't we the Pharisees? We too engage in spiritual practices with special intention, believing they will make us better. The thing is, spiritual practice is not actually about being better. It's about being connected, being free. Stewardship, for example, is at its best a spiritual practice of liberation. It liberates us from assumptions of self-sufficiency and economic commodification. Pledging from our wages connects us to our community and to God's generosity in tangible ways. But it can accidentally become a rule to follow or a way to affirm ourselves. And when we become trapped in that pattern, we miss something profound and liberating. We miss God in the midst of us, delighting in our very being, beckoning us to respond in kind. I think another assumption that Jesus confronts here is the idea that God is impressed by our good deeds. For those of us who have grown up assuming that Christianity is about doing the right thing, this assumption is particularly hard to let go, but it's worth it. Because when we idolize our good deeds, we don't connect to other people very well. We miss the chance to see God's image in those we assume are less capable than we are of doing good in the world. And then, trapped in assumptions that justify ourselves, we leave little room for God's mercy and belonging to flourish in our lives. I sit with all of this and I wonder, if Jesus were going to tell us a liberating parable today, who would he tell us about? What would he say? I don't pretend to know, but here's one idea. Christina Cleveland, a Black theologian and social psychologist, tells the story of a group of evangelical white upper-class moms who called to get her advice about increasing diversity in a mom's prayer group in their community. Their neighborhood school was diverse, they explained, but their mom's group was not. So the group's leaders had been trying to connect with Hispanic and low-income families living in an adjacent neighborhood. It was a good idea, but despite many invitations, they had not succeeded in getting anyone to join them. And in their failure to connect, these moms had assumed that advocating and praying for children was just not a priority for their neighbors. So Dr. Cleveland asked them, "What about your life makes it possible for you to meet at 11 a.m. on a Thursday morning. "Well," said one of the leaders, "we love our kids, and so we've made the decision to partner with our partners to stay at home and to prioritize our family life." "That's not the right answer," Dr. Cleveland responded. She suggested that the group of leaders immerse themselves in the lives of their Hispanic neighbors and low-income neighbors for a few months to see if they could answer the question differently. So these evangelical white moms started taking families to the nearby Hispanic church in their neighborhood instead of driving across town to the mostly white megachurch. They discovered that many in the community were working three and sometimes four jobs to make ends meet. Most were dependent on public transportation, and all of them loved their kids as much as they did. After a few months, one of the leaders called back to report to Dr. Cleveland. She explained that they had changed their meeting time to 11 p.m. They were meeting in the homes of those who couldn't afford childcare. They were paying for an interpreter to come to their meetings. And in addition to supporting their students together by praying, the moms group had started advocating for immigration reform. Then the leader on the phone said humbly, "For the first time in my life, I have flesh on my bones. How was I living before? How did I know God before?" Can you hear it? Mercy, humility, freedom, connection. The good news is that life can be different for all of us when we let go of our assumptions in order to receive the frighteningly free gift of God's presence in our midst. Social assumption busting is a slow, messy process, and we need it today at least as much as Jesus' original band of followers did. But it's not a hustle. It's a letting go, a liberation. In just a few moments, we will stand together and say profound words about Jesus' death, life, and resurrection. Our worship frees us from the idea that we can do any of the spiritual work alone, and it tempts us to give up our assumptions for something upending and truly life-giving. If such a messy hope unsettles you, you are not alone.